science literacy and science education is an oxymoron, insofar as youth of color, particularly African-American youth, are not perceived as having the intellectual capacity and aptitude, you know, to succeed in particularly the elite science, math, technology, and engineering courses. That AP course taking and exam taking among African-American students and Latino students to a lesser extent is abysmal, you know, because of the apartheid structure of American education.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, being culturally relevant, being first in the family, and more. Welcome to the Humanist Hour. I'm Kim Ellington. My co-host Beau is off doing Beau things today. Today I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Sakibu Hutchinson. Dr. Hutchinson has a PhD from NYU, and she's the founder of Black Skeptics of LA, as well as the author of several books, including The Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and The Values War, and several other books. Today we're going to be discussing her newest work, White Knights, Black Paradise. And here we are with Dr. Sakibu Hutchinson. Thank you for being with us today, Sakibu.
Hi, glad to be here.
So you have a lot of different projects that you do, and I want to get into some of those a little bit later. But first, I want to hear about this new book that you have out called White Knights, Black Paradise. First of all, the name is intriguing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the name comes from the Jonestown People's Temple settlement tragedy. So, just to provide a brief snapshot, there were over 900 members of People's Temple Church who immigrated to Jonestown, Guyana in the 1970s, and they were involved in a murder-suicide pact / massacre and died in Jonestown on November 18th, 1978. And so as part of that suicide pact, they would engage in what were known as white knights. And so a white knight siege was basically a racial terrorism threat that was more or less fabricated by their leader, the Reverend Jim Jones, in order to establish solidarity and elicit fear and obeisance among the members. So that's where the first part of the book's title comes from. The second part comes from the idea and narrative that was propagated among the church leadership and conveyed to the membership that Jonestown, Guyana represented a kind of racial utopia, that it was going to be a place where there would be, the ultimate solidarity of African-American and white and multiracial members, and that it would be an antidote to the racial discrimination and racial harassment that the church was experiencing in the United States. And it was really viewed as sort of a culmination of, you know, Black diasporic travel, Black diasporic imaginings, sort of a tail end of the great Black migration.
Okay.
So the title encapsulates a number of different thematic strands that existed, you know, within the temple and within African-American community at large.
I was actually born in the early 70s, so this was fascinating to me because this is, of course, something that happened way before I was an aware human being. And pretty much all that, you know, from my experience, everybody's is different. You know, I heard about Jonestown, and it wasn't actually until the recent years that I found out that a predominance of the folks at Jonestown were Black and that Jim Jones was white. It's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I wonder how many people know that. One of the many things that's neglected to be mentioned in our history books.
Yeah, indeed. And that was one of the primary impetus for me writing this book. When I was looking at the research and the scholarship, there was very little that focused on the fact that the predominant membership of People's Temple and those who died in Jonestown were African Americans, primarily African American women. Black women played a huge role in the People's Temple movement, and this was a church congregation that spanned from the 1950s into the late 1970s. It encompassed members in congregations in Indiana, in Redwood Valley, California, in Los Angeles, California, and San Francisco. And again, most of these iterations were African-American members of all generations, all class backgrounds, all sexual orientations, all professions. So these were the kinds of nuances and complexities that I want to bring out in the book that I had not seen, really articulated in any meaningful way in both the nonfiction, the scholarship, and the literary representations of People's Temple in Jonestown.
Which makes sense. What did you do to find this information? Since if I just did a quick Wikipedia lookup and there's not a lot on that subject of who the folks were, there's a lot more emphasis on the politics of the situation. Where did you start?
I started with the Alternative Considerations for Jonestown website, which is a really rich treasure trove of information. It encompasses reflections from survivors. It has scholarly archival information. It has transcripts from some of the speeches that Jones gave. It has audio. So it's a constellation of a number of different historical documents that any researcher, any amateur scholar can go to. And there used to be an institute that was totally dedicated to Jonestown memorabilia and documentation at San Diego State University. So I worked with the founders of the Jonestown Institute, Fielding McGee and Dr. Rebecca Moore. I also interviewed survivors. I went to one reunion of survivors and members of People's Temple in Jonestown. And I was able to get, I think, a fairly complex and nuanced snapshot of some of their recollections and their attempt to analyze and interpret and place in context what had transpired, in their lives, how it had been impacted quite deeply and politically, by the institutionalization of the People's Temple mindset of collectivity, of socialist organizing, of social justice, of multiracialism, of collaboration. These were some of the positive attributes that I wanted to foreground in the novel that I felt were not adequately highlighted in a lot of the memorialization from others, not from survivors, that I saw on Jonestown and People's Temple.
That's great. I think because what we hear about pretty much is the overused phrase probably is don't drink the Kool-Aid. That's kind of what pop culture has gotten out of this. And it seems like you found a whole lot more.
Yeah, and that's absolutely a misnomer. And, I've talked about that quite a bit in some of my more scholarly takes on People's Temple in Jonestown. That the myth was that you had these bug-eyed acolytes who were following Jones and, drank the Kool-Aid willingly when, first of all, there was no Kool-Aid. It was Flavor Aid. It was a cocktail of cyanide and Flavor Aid. And there were multiple things going down, during that fateful evening. I mean, you had folk that did elect to drink the cyanide Flavor Aid cocktail. You had folk that were forced to drink it, possibly at gunpoint. And you had some folk that were forcibly injected with it. And it's important to note that there were over 300 children who perished in the massacre.
300 of the around 900?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I actually hadn't read that yet. That's horrifying. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, why did you use a fiction piece as opposed to a nonfiction piece?
I thought it would be more compelling to try and integrate all of the strands of ideology, of worldview, of background, of generation, of sexual orientation that existed within People's Temple. I mean, this was a very vibrant movement. It was a movement that, again, existed across time, across, geographic, designation. And I felt that it was incumbent upon me as a black feminist to try and portray that imaginatively, in a way that had not been done before, because there have been reams and reams produced about the phenomenon of Jonestown, about this epic tale of, you know, self-destruction and debauchery. And they have primarily been done through the lens of the white followers and the white leaders of People's Temple and Jonestown. And there's been a whole cult of fetishization, you know, sort of memento mori fetishization of Jones, of Jim Jones. So I wanted to try and deconstruct that via fictionalization. And I just come off of, you know, writing Godless Americana was a collection of essays, you know, on secular humanism, atheism, social justice, and organizing. And I wanted to branch out and do something that was qualitatively, substantively different.
Yeah, and I definitely think you did that. I've gotten to read almost all the book. I did skip a little to the end as well. And I was engrossed. I couldn't put it down. So I can say, at least from my point of view, you did a really good job with that, because I was fascinated by your characters. And it's intriguing to think from a reader's point of view that this could be, like, everything that you came up with based on the facts that you found out from folks and their experiences, this could be very well similar to what actually happened to a lot of folks or very close to that kind of story. You do a lot of other things besides write. I actually saw you speak in Denver last year at the American Humanist Association on a panel with Dr. Penn and Monica Miller and Chris Driscoll. And that was a really, really powerful bit that you did there. Do you mind talking about that for just a minute?
We were looking at the degree to which humanism intersects with movements for self-determination for people of color. And, you know, really pushing back against the myth of color blindness and meritocracy that informs much of new atheist discourse and, to a certain extent, humanist European-American discourse. So my presentation was oriented towards looking at the criminalization of communities of color and how that informs African-American secular humanist thought and organizing, how we can begin to talk about racial subjectivity and racial identity in ways that are not demonizing, in ways that are not othering vis-a-vis mainstream humanism. I'm especially interested as an educator in looking at culturally responsive humanist education and, you know, making a connection between redressing the policing, the criminalization, the dehumanization of the bodies and, you know, the identities of young people of color, talking about more, you know, activist ways of approaching youth leadership development and curriculum in public schools that are very much under siege by high-stakes testing, by you know, the paramilitary presence of police on campuses of color, by you know, the lack of visibility of, you know, African American, Latino, Native American, and Asian Pacific Islander social history in our curricula and in our textbooks. So these were all strands that I was trying to weave into my talk to try and broaden humanist horizons.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. I'm your co-host, Kim Ellington, and today we're speaking with Dr. Sakivu Hutchinson. As an educator, one of the things that, you know, my experience of, I grew up in New Hampshire, and in the, like I said, in the 70s and 80s, so that's kind of the time frame in the part of the country that I grew up in. And looking back, there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, our history books are pathetic compared to what actual history is. And they are terribly, terribly European-centric. I'm curious, as I talked to, I think, Mandisa Thomas, we talked about this as well. What do we need to do to integrate the history of all Americans into, I think, because I really think that's where it starts in elementary school. If I learned that, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King fixed civil rights and now we're done, you know, that's kind of the narrative that I learned growing up. And it's not until I became an adult and actually within the last, you know, 10 to 15 years where I was like, oh, well, that's not exactly true.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I mean, there are a number of different things that can be pursued that are being pursued. I mean, certainly, you know, lobbying with local school boards, you know, trying to pass legislation that makes culturally responsive and culturally relevant education mandatory. I mean, we've had tons of, you know, different policies, particularly where I am in Los Angeles Unified School District, that affirms the value of cultural responsiveness, you know, not only in the curriculum, but in teaching methodology. So these are concrete, specific things that humanists in their local communities can do, you know, to engage with the power structure, you know, to try and push back against white supremacy in curricula and in pedagogy. There's also the dynamic of working with organizations that are doing authentic youth leadership development around social and gender justice. And this is what I do, you know, as an educator and as a resource provider, that I have a young women's leadership project, which has been supported at various points by the American Humanist Association in terms of, you know, donations to our Black Skeptics First in the Family Humanist Scholarship Fund. We also started a young male scholars pilot because African-American males have extremely low rates of college going, extremely high rates of being pipelined into prisons and juvenile facilities. So these are, again, some very localized things that folks that have critical consciousness around the apartheid structure of American education can do.
Tell us about the First in the Family. What is this?
The First in the Family Humanist Scholarship Fund was something that Black Skeptics Los Angeles started in 2013 in response to the crisis of mass incarceration in South LA specifically. We award 4 to 5 scholarships annually to young people that are undocumented, that are homeless, that are foster care designated, that are system involved, and or LGBTQ, because these are the populations that are most vulnerable for prison pipelining, for being pushed out of school, for being denied equitable opportunities to college preparation and college access. So we've gotten support over the past several years from a wide array of humanist and secularist organizations. AHA is one. The African Americans for Humanist organization is another. Foundation Beyond Belief. We got a major grant from the Freedom From Religion Foundation last year and this year to support youth of color scholars, First in the Family, college-going students who identified as secular, humanist, agnostic, or atheist.
That's great. I grew up in a foster family. Mm-hmm. Let me be clear that I was the biological child of two people who took in foster kids. And I think, I know for a fact that, you know, the experiences that I've had there, people are always like, oh my gosh, how was that like? What was that like? And I think that's one of those many things that if we don't tell it, people don't know that fostering is not, you know, it's not this ideal. It's not like, oh, well, they're in a foster family. They're just fine. They'll be fine now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a crisis in communities of color around foster care designation and placement. And this has a lot to do with prison pipelining in our communities. You know, the fact that if you have a parent who is convicted of a non-violent drug-related offense and is sentenced to prison, what happens to the children? Well, if it's African-American kids, they are more than likely going to be placed in group homes or other facilities where they're vulnerable to being abused, you know, to being targeted, to get their school age, being pushed out of school because they don't have equitable resources. So these were the kinds of things that we identify as important to address within a humanist context. And that's why we developed the First in the Family, a humanist scholarship, because foster care youth have abysmal college-going rates, are more likely to become homeless because they don't have a social safety net, are more likely to become incarcerated because they don't have a social safety net.
Yeah, and I can say from my experience, I know for a fact that several of the kids that we had over the years, that's exactly what happened, and where they are in and out of. It's, yeah, I think that's great. How do you identify the kids that can use the scholarship and benefit from it?
We work with the local school districts. We work with schools in South LA, resource providers, professionals that deal with foster care and homeless and indigent youth. You know, we work with the local union. We've recruited with faith-based, you know, organizations. We recruit with local politicians. So we have a number of different stakeholders that we interface with in order to try and identify youth who would be appropriate.
That's great.
And we also try and provide some aid to our alum. We have young people that are in the UC system, that are in the Cal State system, that are, now that we've branched out nationally, UT Austin, University of Pittsburgh. So over the past now 3 years, we have a very rich and extremely energized and activist cadre of young people who have gotten these scholarships.
One of the things that you said at the AHA conference was, for those humanists, atheists who are progressive and of color, that you've always found your humanism inseparable from anti-imperialist, I think anti-racist, pro-feminist type movement. And that, can you speak to that a little bit for what you found in what we'll call, I guess, the new atheist type movement, what's going on now or what has been going on?
Well, one of the things that inspired me to write Moral Combat was the fact that I did not see any critique within new atheist discourse of actual conditions of socioeconomic disenfranchisement, racial injustice, apartheid, and the dehumanization of women under patriarchy and misogynist systems of power, authority, and control. And these have always been critical for Black secular humanists and other secular humanists of color with a more left, radical, progressive bent. And I'm thinking of people like A. Philip Randolph, who came from the labor organizing movement, you know, who was the founder of the original, you know, March on Washington movement, you know, for jobs and enfranchisement, who was a socialist, who, you know, pushed back against what he called, you know, orthodox Christianity, you know, because of its poverty, pimping, and prosperity gospel orientation, you know, within certain elements of the African-American faith community. So these are the traditions that African-American secular humanists who have some real war orientation come from. And there was an absolute deficit of that kind of consciousness, critique, and analysis within New Atheism, which we know, you know, tends to fetishize church-state separation and science within a very, very limited realm. So there's no emphasis on the fact that in most schools of color that are high poverty, science literacy and science education is an oxymoron, insofar as youth of color, particularly African-American youth, are not perceived as having the intellectual capacity and aptitude, you know, to succeed in particularly the elite science, math, technology, and engineering courses. That AP course taking and exam taking among African American students and Latino students to a lesser extent is abysmal, you know, because of the apartheid structure of American education, because of the emphasis on high stakes tests and drill and kill, you know, pedagogy and curricula and paramilitary presences on our campuses. So these are things that I've been pushing back against for the past several years, you know, in my writing, in my public speaking, and looking at why is it that the new atheist movement, you know, has such a great emphasis on, you know, pushing back against biblical literalism and the hostility towards evolution and, you know, the hostility towards, you know, science courses within mainstream public education, but there's no connection to the apartheid structure, you know, within American public education that militates against Black and Latino students being provided with the resources and the access that they need to excel in science education.
Which I think has a lot to do with the prevalent fallacy of meritocracy that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are so many students that I work with that are absolutely brilliant, that are STEM aligned, and they tell me that either I'm one of two African American students in my AP physics class or AP calculus class or, you know, AP chemistry class, or there are no African American students in these classes, and I'm having difficulty gaining access to them because I'm not perceived as intellectually capable enough to succeed in this class. And we know that AP classes are absolute gatekeepers to admission to competitive colleges and universities.
So then that makes these your scholarships for the First and Family even more important for a lot of folks. All right. So can you tell me a little bit more about moral combat? And because you cover a lot of subjects in that book as well, and I don't know that if a lot of folks know about it. Can you give us a little synopsis there and some ideas so that we can get a little juicy taste of what we could read?
So moral combat was an encapsulation of a lot of the issues that I've been talking about. I started from the premise that the U.S. is hyper-segregated, and that hyper-segregation informs the high levels of religiosity among African Americans. That, yes, we've had traditions of, you know, the black church, you know, very much engaged with, you know, pushing back against structures of white supremacy and, you know, legacies of enslavement, apartheid, and Jim Crow. But contemporarily, the reason why black churches remain fixtures in predominantly African-American communities is precisely because of the nature of capitalist exploitation. Precisely because our communities are so segregated that, according to a lot of the data, upper-middle-class African-Americans are far more segregated residentially and professionally in many regards than are white working-class and lower-middle-class folk. And so this segregation breeds a reliance upon churches and faith-based institutions because these are some of the only institutions in our communities that provide social welfare services, that provide connections for African-American professionals, that provide educational resources, after-school programs, green spaces, extracurricular, you know, programs and resources. So that was one of the things that I focused on in developing the thesis, you know, for moral combat. And again, contrasting, you know, this dynamic with that which exists within white secular new atheist enclaves and communities. The fact that white secularists do not have to be concerned with being criminalized or policed at any class level. In contrast with African Americans, secular, atheist, working class, middle class, upper class, there's always that element of being policed, of being criminalized, and being perceived as the outlier other that is antithetical to mainstream society in any particular context. So these were the themes that I wanted to weave into moral combat. And also coming from a black feminist perspective and looking at why it's been so important for African-American female secularists to push back against the misogyny and the heterosexism, the homophobia, the transphobia, and the respectability politics of the contemporary black church.
So one of the things that I have come across in the last few years is the, unfortunately, the Say Her Name hashtag. And that actually speaks a lot to the criminalization and the othering, I guess, of black women in general. So that's something else that our listeners can look up to get some idea of some of the specifics of what Sakivu is talking about here. One of the other things I would like to talk about is you have a seminar coming up in January at Rice University in Houston, the Secular Social Justice Seminar. Can you tell us something about that?
Yes, that's going to be a conference held at the end of January at Rice University, and it's going to bring together a broad array of scholars, of activists, of educators, of community members who identify as secularists, humanists, atheists, etc., all of color. And, you know, the idea is to focus on many of the themes that I've already invoked, looking at gender justice, you know, from a woman of color lens, looking at the racial politics and the myth of colorblindness that exists within the new atheist movement and to a certain extent the humanist movement, addressing issues of economic justice, activism, and the racialized wealth gap, you know, from a secularist of color perspective. Looking at modes of African-American cultural production and expressivity that pertain to the interface of humanism and hip-hop. I'm also addressing the perspectives of LGBTQ, gender non-conforming atheists of color, and the degree to which there is a disconnect within the white LGBTQ, you know, atheist community, as well as a disconnect within the LGBTQ mainstream, white-dominated community.
Excellent. And people can find that online? More information?
Yes.
Yes, okay,
it's secularsocialjustice.com.
Okay, easy enough. And people can also find your writing in a lot of places. You contribute to several blogs. Can you tell us a few of those?
I contribute to blackfemlens.org. That's my blog. Also, thefeministwire.com, truthout.org, and, of course, there's Huffington Post, LA Progressive, and periodically to AHA's The Humanist magazine.
Very nice. Perfect. And if folks want to, well, not if, when they want to find your book, where should they go to get that?
They can go to Amazon, and they can also go to my website, which is KibuHutchinson.com.
Excellent. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners today about White Knight's Black Paradise or any of the other subjects we've talked about?
Well, I mean, I hope people are stimulated enough to check the book out. And I also want to encourage folk that may be in the Houston area in January to come and participate in the Secular Social Justice Conference. It's going to be extremely dynamic and groundbreaking.
Yeah, I'm excited about both. Yeah, folks, seriously, White Knight's Black Paradise, like I said, it pulled me in. And if you're even thinking to yourself you don't care too much about any of this stuff, if you like historical fiction even, just there, boom, it's a great story, but there's a lot more to it. And I think it's great that we have the opportunity to speak with you today about this. All right, Dr. Sakibu Hutchinson, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Kim. Appreciate it.
Again, thank you to Dr. Sakibu Hutchinson for a great interview. And folks, White Knight's Black Paradise, an excellent read no matter why you like to read. I'd like to leave today with a quote from David Foster Wallace that I think is relevant to this conversation and many others that we're having now in the community. He said, "Humanism, free thinking, and the like isn't really about the capacity to think, but rather about the choice of what to think about." And that was a theme at the AHA conference. It's been a theme, I think, that's spreading a little bit more throughout the community. And as Sakibu talked about, it's not, humanism isn't all about scientism. And there are other things that we need to focus on and think about as we choose how we want to go out through this world.
Hey, everybody, this is post-production Bo Bennett, adding a little interview to fill up the time that Peggy Knutson did with Richard Carrier at the Skeptics of Oz conference, I would say a few months ago. But the information is timeless. So here we go.
Hi, I'm here today with Dr. Richard Carrier, and we are at the Skeptics of Oz conference in Wichita, Kansas. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So tell me a little bit about what you're going to be speaking on today at the conference.
Today I'm going to talk about how you could prove that miracles occurred in history, if ever there were miracles. The big takeaway of the talk is going to be that there haven't been any, and therefore that's why we can't. It's interesting. It's going to be a different take on this talk. I gave a talk, and I'll talk about it today as well, but for Skepticon a few years ago called Miracles in the Historical Method. And the whole gist of that talk was basically about why we can't prove that miracles existed in history, but it wasn't because there was a logical problem. It wasn't that it was impossible in principle. It's just that the data just isn't there, right? And so I went through all of the details, and it's a good extensive, I go through examples of like pagan miracles in antiquity and stuff, so I talk about a variety of different aspects of that. And all going through the fact that, you know, rapidly growing ridiculous legends happened all the time, and like all of these things, lots of data is missing, and so on. So there are a lot of reasons why we just don't have any verifiable miracles in history. And so that whole talk is about that. This talk, ironically, is going to do the exact opposite and argue that you can prove miracles existed, except it's going to be dealing with it from the perspective of fiction, because there aren't any miracles. If there had been, we would have proved them by now. But so I'm going to talk about that and how that illustrates historical methodology. And also, in a sense, it kind of answers the question you often get from Christians, like, what would convince you?
Right.
And you know, the many ways to answer that question about, like, what would convince... And usually, I would immediately respond to that as, convince me of what specifically? Because you have to say, what, like, the Catholic God exists? Or that there are miracles? Or that, you know, which kinds of things? So you have to be very specific as to what would convince me. And then I can lay out, like, oh, so I can give you an example of one thing. And the funny thing is you'll answer that question that way and to say, well, like, this would convince me. And to say... oh, that's just the only set of circumstances that would convince you. And it's like, no, it's just an example of what
example.
We would do. And so to really answer that question, you need to be able to explain broader principles. Like, if you're going to give several examples, what do all those examples have in common that are the thing that would convince you? Right? So so that's what I'm going to talk about today is what is the general principle of what would convince us?
And do you have any opinions on if you were speaking to a religious believer and what would convince them a miracle mm-hmm. happens as opposed to someone who's more of a skeptic, what it would take to convince them?
Yeah.
Is there a wide variance there and... What's your experience with that?
Well, of course. I mean, in fact, the speaker who just went on at the beginning today, Jeff Jarman, just did a whole talk on that whole aspect of it, is that if you say something that they already are motivated to believe, they don't need reasons to believe it, right? So yes, I'm going to say you describe any badly evidenced miracle, and as long as it's a miracle they want to be true, they're going to say, oh, yeah, that's enough to convince me. But if you then make it a miracle in another religious tradition that contradicts their religious beliefs, now they're like a super skeptic, right? So now they bring out
exactly.
all of the tools, and they give all these good reasons why that's a dubious claim. And then they just don't make the connection to realize that, yeah, you're being a really good skeptic here. All those reasons to reject that claim are totally correct. Like, you've done a really good analysis of the problems. Notice that your miracle claim that you liked has all the same problems, right? You just have to apply the same critical thinking to the ones that you want to be true.
It also seems to me like miracles today are a dime a dozen. I don't know if that is the case, but how do you think the... idea or the concept of miracles has changed from ancient times, Roman, Greek,
mm-hmm.
To today, where every morning on every morning talk show, there's some miracle that has happened. It seems like the definition of the word has changed almost.
Well, that's true, and to an extent, that's always been true. That anything that's amazing is a miracle, right? So that even if it's totally natural and science can totally explain it and has explained it, then there's nothing actually supernatural about it. It can be miraculous because it's amazing in some way. It's unusual. It's uncommon. Unexpected.
But it's always amazingly good.
Yes, that's true too. Yes,
because
right.
Because there are amazing things that are tragic,
yeah.
But no one calls those a miracle.
That's interesting because in antiquity that distinction didn't exist because you did have terrible miracles. They were omens and signs, right? Yeah. So you could have like monstrous events would be signs of something bad. And you don't see that very often. Like, you see that a little bit today. Like, someone will say the blood moon is a bad sign, but that's not really a miracle. Everybody knows what a blood moon is, right?
The concept really has changed.
It has evolved, and it's evolved really in a way that's a response to the scientific revolution, because we've changed the fundamental way that we understand facts about nature now. Now, there were scientists in antiquity, and there were... naturalists in that sense, that they would have an idea of what natural law was and a miracle would violate natural law. But that wasn't generally the common view. I mean, a miracle is just attributed to divine agency, right? So it could be anything would be a miracle as long as you could credit God with doing it, right? Even if you used the laws of nature to accomplish it. Nowadays, when people talk about miracles, unless they're being, you know, just... casual, they don't really mean a miracle, they're using miracle like a, you know, as just a way to say amazing. Usually when people say miracle and they mean it, they're also attributing divine agency to it, but it's important to them that divine agency defy the laws of nature, because otherwise, if you can say, like, yeah, it's a miracle that their cancer went into remission, even though, you know, we can totally explain why that happened in terms of, you know, biochemistry, and we understand how cancers, you know, can actually malfunction themselves, because they are malfunctions. So cancers can kill themselves. It's possible. It's just not very common. And if someone were to accept that, that pulls God out of the equation, because now he's like, oh, now you don't need God to explain it. That becomes a threat to their religion, right? So so it's important for them that, that somehow that cancer remission has to defy physics. It has to defy biology, because if it doesn't, then it didn't come from God. And this idea that if you can explain it without God, it didn't come from God, is a much more growing idea now because of the prolific nature of science and the way science has been used to defend atheism over the last 100, 200 years.
And it seems to me like that divine agency is only agency from their belief in the divine.
Oh,
so
sure,
if this were to happen and let's say be equated with an ancient pagan god healing their cancer, that would not have been the case.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and you have that issue. Because Christianity is so dominant, you rarely run into Hindus boasting about the Hindu miracles or Muslims boasting about Muslim miracles. And Christians...
Well, in the United States.
In the United States.
You
know, good point, yes.
See that
In North America, generally.
Right.
And even you can encounter that. It's just people sequester themselves so much that they're generally, you know, your average Christian evangelist is not hanging out with his Hindu neighbor and chatting about their miracles, right? Maybe that happens, but it's just not a common thing. So you have that aspect of it. But there is another side of it too. Like, you have certain religions are denigrated as being sorcery or demonic. So, for example, Santeria has, you know, it has miracles, but there are things like you can cast spells and bring effects, or you can pray to the gods and gods will bring effects. Catholicism will have saints that do the same thing, like the saint performs the miracle, and Protestants think that's dodgy.
Right.
But usually, like, if it's foreign, like, it's not Christian at all, then it's sorcery, then it's demons are doing it. And this is another form of, like, you know, divine evidence, where you have, like, I often get people claiming, it's like, well, we have, like, proof now that demonic possession exists and demonic levitation exists. And this is, oh, you have video? Like, well, no. Oh, okay, so what is your evidence? Okay, they can never come up with any. But this is an example of non-godly, you know, a miracle originating from something that doesn't come from God. And they don't call it a miracle because that would be giving it a positive spin, but it's still a supernatural thing that verifies their religion, because their religion, the ones who make these claims, their version of Christianity allows the existence of demons to interfere and do supernatural acts in the world. And so then they'll attribute that to, like, Santeria is, oh, it's just all demons, right? But that's not the perspective of Santeria practitioners.
Right.
So there's a lot of how they need to verify their particular religion and deny, that requires them to deny other religions, and they can come up with ways to do that. And one way is to even admit maybe Santeria miracles occur, but it's demons. And then another way would be to be super skeptical, you know, be reasonably skeptical about Santeria miracles, but not reasonably skeptical about your own religion's miracles. So there's different strategies available to deal with these, you know, so-called foreign god miracles.
So if a miracle is only a miracle, if it's from divine agency or from God, how do we then place a burden of proof on proving the miracle if it's outside of the natural realm or the natural world?
Right, yeah, that's something I'm going to talk about a little bit today. One thing, distinction I make is between, well, I mean, set aside the whole word miracle. Let's just distinguish supernatural versus paranormal. And that's one of the distinctions I want to make, is paranormal is something that defies current physics as we know it, but might actually be physics. Like, it might be some new physics we haven't discovered yet. So it could have a natural explanation.
I don't hear people often say supernatural versus paranormal. They usually couch it in supernaturalism versus naturalism.
That's right. Yeah. So that's why I keep the two words apart, because paranormal, like, you can have something that looks like a miracle, but it might like defy physics, and you might be able to verify that, oh yes, that really occurred and it really does defy modern physics. But you still don't know the mechanism, so it could still just be naturalism, right? It might not be supernatural. So you have to investigate further. So there's two levels of explanation there. So you have to verify that the thing happened. That's one level. And the other level is what caused it. And that's another level. And that's much harder usually to get a causation, especially of singular events. Like, science usually can only get a causation when it can study tons and tons of events or make the event happen in a lab or while you're watching it in a telescope or something. Like, science often needs the multiple reproducibility of the phenomenon in order to get at the causality of it. When you're looking at events in the past, it's much more difficult to get at the causes of things.
It brings you to the trying to prove miracles historically, because you just don't have the data available.
Yeah, and that's why I'll bring that up a little bit, like, would it even be possible to go to the causal level for a historical event? It's exceedingly difficult. But you could get to the level of verifying the event occurred, and then the interpretation of the causality of that event would depend on your background knowledge of how the world works, which is a broader question that deals with whole worldviews rather than history itself. And I'm actually going to use very specific examples of how, if the world were different than it is, we could verify causality, supernatural causality, much more easily had we lived in a supernatural world, but we don't. So, and that's the reason that it's difficult to get at that particular level of causation.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit here, and I want you to tell me about your teaching online classes now.
Yeah.
They can find your classes, our listeners can find your classes at Partners for Secular Activism.
Yes. Also on my blog, if you go to my blog, down the left margin, there's a list of subjects, one of which is classes, and you can click on that and see which classes I've announced lately. I do one a month. I usually announce the class midway the month before what the topic will be. I do history and I do philosophy. A variety of different topics. So, like, right now I'm teaching a course on Introduction to New Testament Studies. So for people who are lay people but want to have some idea of how to use resources and challenge claims made about the Bible, the New Testament in particular, I'm teaching a basic set of skills and teaching resources that are available to everyone that they can go to that would help them get at, like, translations of the Bible, understand the underlying Greek, even if you don't speak or know Greek. There are tools that can help ordinary people do these things. And so the course is teaching them all of that, plus all the basic background knowledge of what is the mainstream view about where the documents came from and all of these things. So it's basically just a one-month online course. It's learn at your own pace. There's no scheduled events usually, so you can just go on and participate in the forums where I pose questions and you can ask me questions. It's a great opportunity to ask an expert on the subject all the questions you want, right? Because you might have my paid attention.
They can find your blog at richardcarrier.info.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And next month I'm doing critical thinking. Just basic critical thinking skills.
We all need that.
Yeah. So, and I'm doing it from the angle where critical thinking as a field has changed a lot. So it's not just about logic now. There's actually cognitive science aspect to it, and also the role of Bayesian reasoning for lay people who don't do advanced mathematics. You don't need to know math beyond sixth grade to do any kind of the critical thinking that is needed. So I have a one-month course on that teaches all three aspects of critical thinking and how to approach the world and be smarter about stuff.
Well, some of that is above my pay grade on the Bayesian theorem.
Oh, well, you're going to hear more about that today, actually.
Well, I'll have to learn a little more. I was able to listen to a talk you did many years ago at Skepticon also on the four Gospels and how they differed. And
was that Skepticon or was that at a different
venue?
No,
it was at Skepticon.
Okay.
I think it was Skepticon 2 or 3.
Oh yeah, well, 2 I did the Book of Acts. Which I did, that evolved into a chapter in my book on the historicity of Jesus that became like a formal academic study of the thing that I talk about there, but that one I noted that the plot of Acts, the story in Acts, is missing a lot of things that it should have.
That's right.
And it doesn't make sense on the theory that Jesus existed. So it looks like someone grafted a historical Jesus onto an earlier version of the story of the origins of the church, a story that did not have a historical Jesus in it. And that actually explains a lot of the weird attributes of the plot of Acts. So that, yeah, that was that's videos online.
Well, that would be very interesting in your New Testament class.
Yeah, that could come up
to sort of touch on that a little bit. It was quite fascinating.
And yeah, that might come up. It certainly comes up in when I teach the historicity of Jesus. I teach a course every year on how would you argue for or against the historicity of Jesus. So I teach both sides of the argument.
And some of the other classes that you're going to be
doing
teaching
over time, I do, just intro to historical methods, how to reason critically about history when you're not a historian yourself. I just did recently the science and philosophy of free will, which I think is a really good introduction to all aspects of philosophy. I've done the science and philosophy of practical moral reasoning. I just did a course on that, and I'll do that again next year. And that's, you know, the things along those lines. So I do a variety. I do a counter-apologetics course, like how to interact with Christians on both, not just biblical stuff, but theological and other arguments. How to be more effective. Yeah, yeah, exactly. and in fact, I think December I'm going to co-teach a debating course with Dr. John Shook. And that one will actually have the opportunity for people who pay a little extra to do actual video mock debates where we can schedule a time and we'll engage in the debate and critique the debate.
That sounds really great. I think I could definitely use that information. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been great.
I can't wait for your talk a little bit later in the afternoon.
Awesome.
So thanks to Dr. Richard Carrier for speaking with us here at Skeptics of Oz.
If you have comments or feedback for this episode, you can call us at 202-618-1371, or you can email humanisthour@americanhumanist.org. Thank you for listening.